Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. A household name she is not, but she should be. During Franklin Roosevelt's administration, Frances Perkins was one of America's most influential women. As the first female cabinet secretary, she helped implement programs that reshaped society and business and set the social safety net so many enjoy today. Social Security, unemployment insurance, the minimum wage, the 40-hour work week, Frances Perkins was behind all of them. Kirsten Downey explores Perkins' life and enduring impact as FDR's labor secretary in her book, The Woman Behind the New Deal, The Life and Legacy of Frances Perkins. Kirsten Downey is a former reporter for The Washington Post, and she speaks in town tonight. More on that in just a little bit. And Kirsten, welcome to Kansas City. So nice to have you.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, she was the chief architect of the New Deal. She may have been the most influential cabinet secretary in American history. So why don't we know more about this woman?
Well, it's really kind of interesting, and I think this was sort of the mystery that took me on this journey.
Yeah.
I worked on the book for 10 years.
No kidding.
Yeah, I had to go peeking in a lot of corners and in old archives and all over the country to sort of put together a picture of who Frances Perkins was. One of the things that was so remarkable about her is how active she was in so many areas, but doing it when she took very little credit for the success of the event when it happened.
That's
in fact, I think that was part of the key to her success, is she let other people take the credit for things.
Well, she was a woman.
Yes.
And the first woman is in the cabinet. Is that a factor here in all of this?
Yeah, she really had to sort of invent how to be a woman in public life as a public official herself. She was 40 years old, of course, before she even got the right to vote. So her life was a litany of firsts.
You know, I was really struck by your description of her struggle over how much to talk at cabinet meetings. She was determined not to overdo it, but also not to be invisible. How difficult was it for her to strike the right balance here?
Well, it was very difficult. In public settings, it was very unusual to hear women's voices at all. You know, women were really discouraged from being in the public sphere at all. In fact, it was considered shocking for a woman to eat in a restaurant alone or to stay at a hotel. So women had to learn how to have a public voice. She also felt that men were irritated by hearing women talk. And so she tried to be quite careful about limiting the number of words she used and taking sort of a monotone in the way that she talked to make herself less obtrusive. But she was naturally very chatty, and often she couldn't hold herself back.
And there were all these really nasty notes that other cabinet secretaries, the male cabinet secretaries, would write about her during meetings. What did they say about her as they wrote these nasty little notes?
Well, they were so uncomfortable with it. It was so unusual. FDR himself was quite an unusual person. He had a very strong mother. He had a very strong wife. He was crippled. He was handicapped. So he needed to depend on other people, and he learned to depend on both men and women to help him get things done. So he was unique in recognizing Frances Perkins' potential. But a lot of other men had great difficulty making that adjustment to women in the public sphere.
Yeah.
So what would happen in the cabinet meetings is frequently FDR would ask her a question, and she would start to explain a complicated business or economic issue to him. And the other men in the room would become jealous that she was getting the president's ear. They'd start to pass notes around just like little kindergartners about that she was talking too much and hogging the spotlight. And she had to just keep talking and pretend like she didn't know what was happening.
So clearly she had to spend a lot of private time sort of thinking how she was going to modulate herself and sort of handle herself as a woman in the highest echelons of American government. What kind of drag was that on her? I mean, how much did it drain her sort of being the first woman and having to be on this very precarious perch all the time?
Well, it was. She had to be very conscious all the time, not just about what she did, but how it would be perceived.
Yeah.
They didn't even have a title to call her. They didn't have a way to address a woman Secretary of Labor. So someone came up with the idea of calling her Madam Secretary, which was something that, you know, it just sort of happened, and then they all started calling her Madam Secretary. And she sort of accepted it with some discomfort, but that's how they addressed her. But what was really bad is afterwards they started to call her the madam, and she found that very offensive.
For very obvious reasons.
Yes, right,
here, right?
Right,
yeah,
right.
Not so good. You know, it struck me as so interesting that FDR made her the first woman cabinet secretary, but it wasn't any cabinet post we're talking about here, but she was assigned to the Department of Labor, obviously, which was, and still to some degree today, is still a male bastion. You know, what a double whammy for her to sort of have to take on there.
Yes. One of the things that a lot of people don't remember is that in the 20s and the 30s, the labor movement pretty much excluded women entirely. And so there were very few women labor leaders. So not only was Frances Perkins coming into a department that looked out for the interests of male or workmen generally, it also was supposed to be representing the interests of the labor movement, which were all yeah. men. So there was sort of a double whammy in terms of how that was perceived. But she very quickly proved herself.
The head of the AFL didn't like her. The head of the CIO didn't like her. So, again, choppy waters all around here.
Yes. But she saw herself as representing all the workers, not just the workers in the labor movement.
Yeah. Well, how is she remembered today? Again, this woman who did so much. Social Security, unemployment insurance, the minimum wage. You know, have statues been erected in her memory or not?
Well, I think that was one of the things that I found so compelling and that made me take so much time to write the book is the Department of Labor building in Washington yeah. is named after her. And in fact, I remember very much the first time I heard her name myself. I was taking the tour bus tour of Washington, D.C., where you go around all the monuments on that sort of double-decker tour bus. And that was back in 1988 when I joined the Washington Post. And we passed the building, and I noticed that it was the Frances Perkins Department of Labor. And I'd never heard of Frances Perkins, but I saw it was spelled with an E, and I thought, oh, my goodness, there's a building named after a woman. And when we got down around to the mall, the tour bus driver, who had kind of a comedy patter, said, mentioned that there was a building in town, and he said that it had been named after a woman who had spent 12 years in labor.
So and that's how he made his tips.
So
right?
That's yeah. how, yes. So there was a big laugh, and I laughed too.
Yeah.
But you know, I thought she did a lot more than that, and she shouldn't just be kind of a silly joke on a tour bus ride.
Well, it is amazing. You know, I do cover politics for a living, and I will say I had heard of her, but going through the book, I was a little embarrassed that I didn't know a little bit more, because clearly this is a woman of such major import. But so the building's named after her, but anything else? Is there a statue for her somewhere?
Well, there's an effort right now afoot. Her homestead is still in existence in Damariscotta, Maine, and there's a group that's trying to preserve the house. The homestead, it's just the way she left it when she died in 1965.
It's been empty ever since.
Her grandson lives there now, and he's done his best to keep it as she left it. So there's an effort right now to make that into sort of a museum and retreat. There's also been a Frances Perkins Center created in that town that's trying to get the word out. One of the things they're doing that's really fascinating is they've gotten funding by the AARP to collect people's Social Security stories from America, to sort of tell the story about
wow.
what a big impact Social Security is having. You know, mainly we only hear about Social Security these days when they talk about funding issues or the budget deficit. But in fact, you know, we have 62 million people in America now on Social Security. The program works very well, and we'd like to do more to recognize its success.
You know, we'll talk more about Social Security in just a little bit. What's your home like? I picture a place in Maine must be just an incredible place.
It's a very charming place, but it's a smallish brick house. The family homesteaded there in the 1790s.
Is it on the coast?
It's on the coast in Maine. And it's a family where they had very long history and memories of American history in their family.
Yeah.
So part of what she did in creating the New Deal programs was infused with an understanding of the economic booms and busts in American history.
Wow. So was Social Security her greatest achievement?
Yes. It was the thing she was most proud of. But she did so many other things, it's hard to single out just one.
So she got this idea for Social Security where? Was it original to her, or was she copying some other country somewhere that had done something like it? Or
There were some European countries, most markedly Germany, that had established an old age pension system that was working very well. But Frances Perkins and FDR felt that it needed to be set up in an American way and tied to earnings, not as a dole, not as a gift. You don't get given Social Security. Social Security is not an entitlement, even though people call it that. You work and you earn it. It's an insurance fund.
Mm-hmm. very American, too, isn't
it? Very American, yes.
Yeah. And so she set this thing up. How big of a battle did she have getting it through Congress? Again, this would have been in the wake of the Great Depression, so I'm wondering how difficult a fight that was for her.
Well, it was a very difficult political fight. There's always inertia in Washington, but the crisis was so great during the Great Depression. A third of American workers were out of work. And the group that was the hardest hit was the elderly. It's so funny. It's hard for us to even imagine a time looking back. But a lot of the people that were starving and eating out of garbage cans were senior citizens, because when the labor force got really tight, it was the older people that lost their jobs first and were rehired last.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're visiting with author Kirsten Downey about her book about Frances Perkins, the woman behind the New Deal, the life and legacy of Frances Perkins. If you didn't know anything about her, you should, because this is a woman that really did reshape our society so much as we know it. You can join our conversation if you want to. 816-235-2888. Give us a shot if you have a question for Kirsten Downey. UpToDate@KCUR.org is our email address, and you can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. Her relationship with FDR, this preceded her time in the cabinet. It began when FDR was governor of New York. How did they meet? How did they come together to begin with?
Well, Frances Perkins and FDR had a very long friendship before she became Secretary of Labor. She had first met him in about 1910. She came to know him much more closely when he became governor of New York, and she was the state's industrial commissioner. So they worked very closely. As the Depression hit America, New York State was very badly hit in 1929. Mm-hmm. She began to experiment with programs that would help reduce unemployment in New York first. And then when FDR was elected president, they took those ideas nationwide and she became a Secretary of Labor.
What kinds of programs were those and how effective were they?
Well, there was the main thing was just sort of to try to get people food, to get them something to eat. So initially, some of the programs were sort of make work programs, clean, you know, road work, public facilities, cleaning
public
things,
works,
that sort
of
thing. And then the first and very popular program was the creation of the Civilian Conservation Corps, which put young men, somewhat young women, but a lot of young men to work in camps and facilities all over the country where they did this work. And then later, of course, programs like the Works Progress Administration, known as either the WPA or the PWA, built some of the big bridges, including like the bridge to the Florida Keys, Lincoln Tunnel, a lot of the things that were our key infrastructure in America.
So the CCC began in New York then?
It began in Washington in 33, very soon after she began. But in fact, there were CCC camps everywhere. I'm not sure how many there were in Missouri, but I know there were 21 in Kansas.
Yeah. So clearly, Frances Perkins and FDR got along pretty well.
They got along very well. He completely trusted her. I think in some ways she was his best friend.
Really?
Yes.
Did it go beyond work?
I think it was a deep family friendship. It wasn't a romantic relationship. FDR had his dance card pretty full.
Yeah. You're taking the words out of my mouth.
Right,
yeah.
But he appreciated her intelligence. And what they would do is she would come up with an idea for a solution to a problem, and he would have the political savvy to get the thing accomplished and figure out how to get it in motion in the government. And his wife, Eleanor, would often popularize what they'd done in the ways that she wrote about it in her column and wrote about and talked about it on radio programs.
It was a team.
It was a team. It was a trio.
Yeah. Again, if you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. Kirsten Downey speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. To RSVP for a seat, go to kclibrary.org. Again, tonight at 6:30 at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. When he named her, how big of a leap was he taking politically, and how did he sell the idea, or did he have to sell the idea?
He was very nervous about picking her as Secretary of Labor. She was his last appointment, even though he'd known her longer. And I think on some level they all knew she would be the one that he would pick.
She was the obvious choice.
She was the obvious choice, but it took some courage for him to do it. He didn't know how it was going to be received. And in fact, it got a firestorm of opposition at first.
Really? In what way?
Well, a lot of the labor leaders felt that they'd had to work very hard to get a labor department created that focused on workers' rights and workers' issues. The department was only 20 years old. They felt very much like it was their department, that one of their male labor leaders should be the Secretary of Labor. They were disappointed and angry. And it was disturbing them to realize that not just was she a woman, she was also a social worker. And so she brought a very different perspective to the problems of workers than the men who had headed the labor unions in America.
Did the papers in those days address this whole notion of a woman in the cabinet just that directly?
Yes,
like, is
they
it
did.
Time? Is it appropriate? Can a woman handle it? All those kinds of issues?
Oh, indeed. It was in at the forefront of everyone's minds. They didn't know. For example, they felt like it would be difficult. The men felt that it would be difficult to express themselves forcefully. They might slip into profanity from time to time. They would offend her and that would cause a problem. So they would have lost the ability to communicate effectively with each other.
Now, I'm trying to remember. I'm looking at my notes here, trying to recall exactly what you wrote. But there's your opening chapter in this book, I believe, talks about the fact that she goes to visit FDR, and FDR makes it clear that he'd like her to be his labor secretary. And she goes home, and I believe you wrote that her daughter recalls her mother crying, even sobbing from the other room. At a moment like that, when she's been named to this very high position, why was she sobbing?
Well, she knew it wasn't going to be easy. She knew it would be hard. She knew it might be terribly hard. She had a family that had come from many, many generations of public service of different kinds.
Yeah.
She knew that being in the limelight exposes you to a lot of cruelty. She knew she'd do her best to make good decisions, but they'd still be criticized. And the magnitude of the task was so daunting. The level of unemployment, the hunger, the want, and how to restart the American economy.
The Labor Department being the key department of American government during those very crucial months after FDR took office.
And that was charged with dealing with those problems, yes.
But what a moment, though. You just can't help but think about her alone in that house, sobbing like that at a moment like that. We'll talk about her family. Her family wasn't a whole lot of help to her at that point. Pretty poignant.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Frances Perkins is our topic for this segment of the show. Have you ever heard of her before? And why haven't you heard of her before? We all should have heard of Frances Perkins. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email address, UpToDate@KCUR.org. Rachel from Tonganoxie on the Kansas side. Good morning.
Good morning. I was wondering if you could correct. I seem to recall that she'd also proposed universal health care at one point. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's right. She was a very enthusiastic proponent of universal health care and tried very hard to push it through. It was the last. She had about 10 things that she wanted to accomplish, and universal health care was about number 10. And she thought they would get it done, but she said instead they got hit by World War II and they never got around to it.
Well, more than that, Kirsten, she actually had a list when she walked in to have her interview with FDR at his home in New York before he went to Washington, I think, to be sworn in. She had it scrawled out. She had rapidly scrawled it out, her list of things she wanted to get done, and she was talking to the president off this little note card. By the way, I want to do universal health care reform, too.
Well, she was kind of saying, do these 10 things or I won't do it. She kind of gave him her terms, and this was one of them. What ended up happening, though, with health insurance was accidental, and that was that when World War II finally started and employers were building munitions and ships and planes and everything, and the economy suddenly kicked into gear, employers really needed workers, and there was a wage and price freeze on. And so the incentive that American employers came up with and came to the Roosevelt administration about was, could we offer a free benefit of health insurance? And we would offer it to our workers. Would you agree to that? And the Roosevelt administration said yes. And instead what we got was a vast system of voluntary health insurance for employed people.
Oh, that's interesting. Rachel, how familiar are you with Frances Perkins? I mean, are you sort of like me, like maybe you'd heard of her but didn't know that much? Or
yeah, just a very vague information. Her name rang a bell, and that was just one of the things I thought of was the health care, because I knew about the Social Security.
Yeah. Rachel, I'm glad you called. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Let's go to Harold from Kansas City, Missouri. Harold, you're on Up to Date. Our topic today, Frances Perkins. Good morning.
Yes, thank you. I'm very fascinated in your program. I'm wondering what the relationship between Frances Perkins was with Eleanor Roosevelt, the president's wife and first lady?
Yeah, this is, thank you for that question. It's actually one of the more intriguing relationships that sort of came to light in my research. The two women were, in some ways, they shared very similar goals and a very similar ideological sense of the world. And they were both religious Episcopalians. But they came from very different backgrounds. Frances Perkins was a college graduate. In fact, she'd done graduate work at Wharton School of Business and at Columbia. Eleanor was quite embarrassed at the fact that she had sort of a boarding school education. Hmm. When she wrote in single syllable words mostly. That was very good because it communicated messages
clearly
to a great mm-hmm. number of people. But Frances Perkins was much more intellectual. There was also some awkwardness in the relationship because Frances Perkins was in the seat of power on her own steam. She'd been selected there as a colleague.
On her own merits,
and
yeah.
Whereas Eleanor was uncomfortable in being in the role of a spouse. The power she could wield was, you know, in her role as first lady. So there was a little bit of tension between the two women about that. But I think the thing that's really remarkable about it is even though they weren't entirely compatible, the two women worked together extremely well. And by the time they were old, they were very close to each other. Hmm. And when Eleanor Roosevelt died, it was Frances Perkins that she consulted on how she should handle her will and her some of the relations with her children.
Boy.
Thank you.
Harold,
how
familiar with Frances Perkins are you?
Well, I'm familiar with Eleanor, and so I'm kind of familiar with Frances Perkins. Just such a blazed such a trail for, especially when you realize how chauvinistic the country was in those days. Just an amazing, amazing woman. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just really amazed by this, that this woman, again, we're repeating ourselves, is so important, and yet we're just putting her on our collective maps here today. It's just amazing to me. Harold, thank you for the call. I appreciate
it. Thank you.
Yeah. You know, if she could listen in, you know, Kirsten Downey, to our conversation today and what we're saying about her and how important she was and yet how much today, the extent to which she's been forgotten, how upset would she be that she's been largely forgotten to history despite this portfolio that simply staggers?
She never sought publicity. She didn't do anything she was doing to get famous or to get power or wealth yeah. or anything. She wasn't motivated by that. She was
imagine that, a powerful person not motivated by all that stuff.
Well, she was extremely religious, and she actually wrote a lot of the parts of the New Deal, the legislation, when she was on religious retreat.
Really?
Yes, in a convent in Catonsville, Maryland. She would go on the weekends and pray and write legislation.
She would do this. She wrote the New Deal, right, what, in 32, right after FDR was elected?
Well, there's a number of pieces of legislation that all go into making the New Deal, and they all would go through numbers of revisions before they would become law. And but the nuns in Catonsville, Maryland, recalled seeing her on her hands and knees in the chapel in Catonsville.
Praying.
At night.
Wow. Wow. And again, were these her ideas, or was she collaborating with FDR to come up with the 40-hour work week and Social Security and those kinds of things? Or how did the whole thing sort of come together?
Well, it was very challenging because the Supreme Court was very conservative. In fact, it was so conservative they called it the Battalion of Death. That no progressive legislation could pass through. So one of the challenges
after all those years of Republican presidents that preceded
yes,
FDR's time in office,
that's exactly right.
Conservative Republican presidents, yeah.
Conservative Republican
Harding,
presidents
Coolidge,
who did
Hoover,
not believe yeah. that the federal government had any role involving itself yeah. in the economic life of Americans in a lot of different ways.
Sure.
And those issues remain alive today. But what she had to do is very carefully draft a lot of the pieces of legislation and tie them to the taxing authority. So, for example, Social Security thus is created as a tax.
And that was
legal and permitted under the Constitution.
I was going to say, that's important why. You just
yes.
explained that.
Yes,
yeah.
yes,
yeah.
yes.
Well, that's really something. But she was savvy enough to understand the nuances even of legislation like that?
She was quite brilliant, and she surrounded herself with very brilliant lawyers. She had a series of young men who were solicitors of labor, mostly young men in their late 20s, very well educated, idealistic, and who came up with some innovative ways to write legislation that would help it survive. challenge in the courts.
Let's talk about her family a little bit, because, you know, one of the reasons that she's not better known, and again, we're talking about Frances Perkins, the first woman cabinet secretary. Franklin Roosevelt appointed her. She reshaped American society on so many different levels. You know, one of the reasons she's not better known is that, you know, her daughter had issues.
Yes.
And those issues resulted in her destroying a lot of her mother's personal papers.
Yes.
That, you know, might have sort of elevated her profile and made your job writing this book a whole lot easier.
Yes.
I can only imagine.
Well, it's a fascinating thing. Frances Perkins' husband, Paul Wilson, had bipolar disorder. He was manic depressive, and he became very ill. When he was about 40 years old, and he was never able to work again.
And he was a dependent very much on his wife.
He was a dependent on her. During his manic phase, he took all their investment money, all their savings, and gambled it away.
Ah.
And so she found out not that just he was ill, that he had a lifetime mental illness, but that they had no money.
And that lack of money affected her the rest of her life. Even after she leaves the cabinet, she ends up teaching as a professor. Princeton, or I can't remember.
At Cornell.
At Cornell,
she had to make money the rest of her life, because as it turned out, when her daughter got to be about 20, her daughter had the same inherited ailment, and they didn't have the medications to deal with it that we have now. So what it was is you dealt with it with rest and retreat and very careful supervision of people so they wouldn't hurt themselves or embarrass themselves in some way that would be painful. So this was expensive. She had both her husband and her daughter, who had to be institutionalized at times or required expensive care. She worked until the day she died, when she was 85, to raise money to take care of them.
That's just amazing to me. And again, the daughter destroyed so many of her personal papers. How difficult did that make your job?
Well, this was very interesting. You know, it's a terrible thing. You know, mental illness is a very big challenge, not just to the person who has it, but to their family as well.
Yeah.
And her daughter, when she was sick, would need her mother's help. When she would feel better, she would be angry at her mother's interference in her life. She felt like she was being monitored. She felt like she was being infantilized. And she came to feel resentful to her mother. And she did destroy or sell some of her mother's papers. And I met Susanna Coggeshall when I was doing the book, and actually she was very helpful
to me.
She's
still alive.
No, she died about 2006, I'd say.
The daughter you're talking about.
Yes, yeah. Yes. What was really amazing, though, is that she had not destroyed all the papers that we thought she had destroyed. In fact, a cache of papers had been put in what they call the vault at Butler Library, which is the manuscript library at Columbia University. And it included doctor's reports on both her father and on herself that confirmed that her mother had indeed taken care of all her life. And that also did me and did posterity the favor of showing us that Frances Perkins had been a loving wife and mother.
So you had access to those papers?
After Susanna died. She had had them sealed until she died.
What was she like, Susanna?
Extremely intelligent, artistic.
Imagine that, yeah.
Very beautiful, slim and lovely when she was a young girl, especially with very beautiful blonde hair, very stylish. She ate very little. She starved herself. That was part of the problem. But she did look lovely because of it.
Yeah.
And she dressed beautifully. Her mother dressed her in the top of fashion. So when I met Susanna, she was in her 80s, but still charming, still engaged, and had a very active life in the artistic world in New York. She was married to a photographer named David Hare, and that is itself a very fascinating sidelight to her life, because David Hare fell in with Frida Kahlo and that gang.
Oh,
and
no kidding.
Frances Perkins found herself having to be very careful about being associated with people who were essentially tied to communists. And so we see there are a lot of reasons that Frances Perkins was very worried about having her life be in the public light. Embarrassment to her husband, embarrassment to her father, her daughter, and embarrassment by her daughter.
Wow. But still, she's going through the Great Depression years, the Roosevelt administration, carrying on her back the fortune of her family. It was all on her. And what a burden that must have been back in the 30s when there was so much mystery surrounding this kind of
ailment. Well, and beyond,
ailment,
and beyond that, when the economy got so terrible, there was a huge movement afoot in the country that women that married women should not be allowed to work outside the home.
Wow.
So she was stepping into a job that had been a man's job as a woman, as a married woman, and confronting the fact that there were lots of people writing to her that said if she had real courage, she would step down and let a man take the job.
How did she handle that?
Diplomatically.
Like everything else in her
life, right?
Again, we're talking about the life of Frances Perkins, a book, The Woman Behind the New Deal, The Life and Legacy of Frances Perkins, Social Security, Unemployment Insurance, and the Minimum Wage. Author Kirsten Downey will be speaking this evening at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. To grab a seat, RSVP, just go to kclibrary.org. What would you, like to have asked Frances Perkins if you'd had a chance? Because I can only imagine after 10 years on working on a very impressive book like this, you must have had a bunch of them.
Well, that's such a good question.
Yeah.
I think that one of the things that I would have asked her, but I think would have been a painful conversation for both of us, is that at the end of her life, she was worried about some of the programs that she created, that there was within them sometimes the potential for abuse. She hadn't realized that there were some people, given the chance not to work, would choose not to work. And so she was concerned about ways that the programs could be gamed and very concerned that people who administer them be do their work in a conscientious and responsible way.
Did she ever say that those programs should be altered or pulled back or restricted in some way because of those kinds of thoughts?
I think the one area I think that she was a little concerned about was what happened with welfare.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't think that, there was such a stigma against illegitimacy when she was alive, that she found it very difficult to realize that some people would not have the same stigma to illegitimacy and some people would have children and seek government benefits.
No,
although she would have not wanted any children to be hurt. Then ultimately the programs are for the benefit not just of the mothers but of the children.
As Frances Perkins rolled through the years, Kirsten, there's this development in her life, her personal life was something that you spent some time on. She befriended wealthy women, well-to-do women. Tell us about that and why she went that way.
Well, it's a really interesting question, and it's one of those open questions. I'm sure if I were to ask her, she would not have given me an answer anyway.
I'm sure not.
But she definitely had some relationships with wealthy women who she had a very difficult time making ends meet because even though she had a fairly good salary as a cabinet officer, she had to maintain appearances a lot of ways, entertain and that sort of thing. It was still very much the at the time when women had to leave calling cards and you had to entertain in certain ways as part of your duties.
And one way to do that was to save some money by living with somebody else.
By living with someone who got the pleasure of hosting important government parties. Who had the wherewithal to do it but didn't have the access that Frances Perkins had.
Mm-hmm.
So she teamed up with several different women in that way and lived with them. But I think there was some level of affection, too.
I was going to say, you talk about romantic relationships here.
Yes. Yeah. Her husband was institutionalized for years at a time, and there was no way out of that. She didn't believe in divorce. She would have never divorced him, and he depended on her, which meant that she was very alone.
Yeah.
And some of the people who were kind to her, extended a hand, were a few wealthy women, two in particular, Mary Harriman, who was the sister of Averell Harriman.
Wow.
And who thus brought her brother Averell Harriman into their orbit.
Mm-hmm.
And a woman named Caroline Love O'Day, who was a congresswoman from New York, who was quite wealthy in her own right. Anyway, there were two relationships that seemed to me to have been more than friendship, but we'll never know for sure.
How long did Frances Perkins live?
She lived till 1965. She was 85.
Wow.
She was still working, still teaching at Cornell, teaching New Deal history and labor economics.
Right down her pike.
Right until she died.
What a great story. I want to thank Kirsten Downey for coming in today and talking about her book on the life of Frances Perkins, The Woman Behind the New Deal, The Life and Legacy of Frances Perkins, Social Security, Unemployment Insurance, and the Minimum Wage. Again, she speaks at 6:30 tonight at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. More information, kclibrary.org. Kirsten, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.